Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for December 30th, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
You're not able to sleep in your bed. You're not able to use your kitchen. You're not able to access your living room. We're not talking about a moderate level of disarray. We're talking about something that is a severe problem for somebody.
Currently, the drug safety community and doctors and scientists have to wait until enough people get sick due to a side effect of a drug before we can detect that that side effect really exists, and then we can warn people about it.
I think if you're going to believe in the 27 Club, then you need to believe in the 25 and 32 Club as well.
DaBabies by 8 months chose the guy who was mean to the mean puppet.
This week, DaBabies have a sense of vigilante justice and predicting side effects of drugs before people take them. And what's the connection between hoarding and collecting? But first, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, and now Amy Winehouse all had one thing in common. They were famous musicians who died at the age of 27. But is the so-called 27 Club a real phenomenon or just a coincidence? To find out, Queensland University of Technology statistician Adrian Barnett and his colleagues analyzed the lifespan of every musician who had a number one hit on the UK album charts between 1956 and 2007.
We did find a very small blip in risk at age 27, but there were also very similar blips at ages 25 and 32. So I think if you're going to believe in the 27 Club, then you need to believe in the 25 and 32 Club as well.
He adds that overall, famous musicians in their 20s and 30s were 2 to 3 times more likely to die than others of the same age. He says being a superstar doesn't make you invincible, and in the end, fame and lifestyle did these musicians in, not an unlucky number. Next, although we may disagree on the details, most humans have an innate sense of fairness and justice. Now, scientists have found that this extends to babies under the age of 1. Correspondent Justin Warner has that story.
Whether it's in a movie or in the news, most people like to see good rewarded and evil punished in the end. And apparently, even 8-month-old babies agree. University of British Columbia psychologist Kylie Hamlin and her colleagues showed babies' elephant puppets being either helpful or obstructive.
So in the case of this study, we show babies a puppet who tried but failed to open a box that contained like a brightly colored toy. So he was sort of trying to open the box and failing, and then one puppet, an elephant, say wearing a yellow t-shirt, came up and helped him open the box. And another elephant wearing a red t-shirt will come up and jump on top of the box and prevent him from getting his toy. And so in our usual studies, we would just have babies choose between those puppets at that point. And what we found over and over again is that they really like the nice puppet who helps open the box.
But this time, Hamlin took the performance a step further.
We showed them a second puppet show in which there were 2 moose puppets who gave a ball to or took a ball away from either the elephant who was nice, so the yellow-shirted elephant, or the elephant who was mean, so the red-shirted elephant.
As expected, the babies preferred the moose to be nice to the elephant who was also nice in the previous scene, but they favored the moose who took the ball from the mean elephant over the moose that gave the wrongdoer a ball anyway. That's a surprisingly sophisticated sense of fairness.
Babies were choosing between someone who rewarded and punished a nice guy versus someone who rewarded and punished a mean guy. And as adults, we would think that actually punishing the mean guy would be better. And that's exactly what we found, that babies by 8 months chose the guy who was mean to the mean puppet.
Hamlin notes that 5-month-olds, on the other hand, favored puppets that were nice to anyone, regardless of their past behavior. It's not clear exactly how babies might use their sense of justice, but the fact that it exists so early suggests it's deeply rooted in our consciousness.
Thanks, Justin. Next, Suzanne answers a listener's question.
TV shows like Antiques Roadshow and Hoarders have brought collecting and hoarding to popular consciousness. Listener Winifred Creamer of Wheaton, Illinois, wants to know why some people become collectors or hoarders, and if the two behaviors are related. We consulted psychiatric researcher Ashley Keller of King's College London. She says that 30% of the adult population has some sort of collection, and 2 to 5% are hoarders. But no one yet knows for sure what might be driving either behavior.
The actual research looking at that is very sparse. This is kind of a new area. We do see in hoarding, people report instances of trauma that might have preempted their saving behaviors. With collecting, it doesn't seem to be that negative spur. Collecting seems to be, you know, a family member encouraged them to do it, or they just find particular joy in their items.
And while some hoarders are also collectors, collections tend to be made up of interrelated items which are highly organized and often displayed with pride.
Every object sort of gains its value by being related to some other object in the collection, whereas with hoarding, you're going to see a large admixture of items. It's really typified by disorganization.
She says hoarders also feel a great deal of distress and embarrassment about their behavior and report that it impairs their daily life.
You create sort of a dangerous space for yourself and for others, and also on a less extreme case, people are unable to have their families over because there's nowhere to sit. You're not able to sleep in your bed. You're not able to use your kitchen. You're not able to access your living room. We're not talking about a moderate level of disarray. We're talking about something that is a severe problem for somebody.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. The most commonly prescribed medications in the United States are antidepressants, but they're all different, and finding just the right match for a patient can take a lot of trial and error. Now, researchers have found a way to predict how well at least one antidepressant will work by testing the patient's blood. Psychiatrist Angelos Hilaris of Loyola University Medical Center in Illinois led the study. His team found that patients with higher levels of a blood protein called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, responded better to an antidepressant called escitalopram.
Much to our surprise, we found out that those with the higher levels at baseline were the ones who had the best response to treatment, as contrasted by those who had the lowest levels who didn't respond to treatment.
In fact, high starting VEGF levels predicted a good response to escitalopram with 85% accuracy. That suggests a simple blood test could predict whether this particular drug would be worth a try. The question now is whether VEGF or other blood markers could predict the success of other antidepressants as well. In our final story this week, Suzanne reports on a new way to detect a drug's side effects before they can harm anybody.
Dangerous drug side effects often show up only after a drug has been on the market for a number of years. For instance, the arthritis drug Vioxx was recalled in 2004, 5 years after it was approved by the FDA, because of an increased risk of heart attacks.
Currently, the drug safety community and doctors and scientists have to wait until enough people get sick due to a side effect of a drug before we can detect that that side effect really exists, and then we can warn people about it.
But what if a drug's unknown side effects could be predicted? Harvard Medical School computer scientists Ben Rice and Alrel Kami and their colleagues set out to do just that. Kami says they analyzed all the relationships that were known in 2005 between 800 drugs and 850 side effects.
Based only on this 2005 data, our model was able to correctly predict about half of the new drug side effect relationships that were reported between 2006 and 2010.
What's more, he says the model only generated a small percentage of false positives. He and Rice think the technique holds great promise for preventing illnesses and deaths.
By moving from detection to prediction, hopefully we'll be able to shave years off of the amount of time it takes before we can warn the public of a potential adverse event of a drug.
Next, they plan to use the model to predict harmful interactions between different drugs.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll listen to some of the earliest sound recordings made by Alexander Graham Bell and recently resurrected from the vaults of the Smithsonian Institution. And we'll tell you how the auditory worlds of chimpanzees and humans overlap. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.